that's the neoliberal argument. I'd be worried if young people weren't different to older people, because I think generational change is important. And I do think that we are, I'm really sorry about the situation that we will find ourselves in. I'm more responsible for it than you are, just by virtue of being 54, and having lived through the slow ruination of, you know, so much that's good about our society. However, I think that it's encouraging if people are at least aware that we are living in a you know, kind of post-apocalyptic society, and the apocalypse that's happened is a social one. The environmental one is coming. You know, the nuclear one, maybe we can't afford nuclear war anymore. It seems to be off the agenda now. We can't afford good newspaper photography, we can't afford decent quality news journalism, so I guess we can't afford nuclear war either.
That's funny though, because during the Arab Spring and the uprising, you know, largely mobilised by kind of communications and images and reporting by social media. And in our context here, I would have thought at the last political elections that there was going to be a Labour-Green hosen, like it was going to be amazing, like they were going to have a complete and utter shift to the left. But I came to realise afterwards that it's because I have X amount of friends on Facebook that I associate with, and they're friends because they largely share the same, you know, ethics or political outlook for me or area of interest. And I honestly saw not one person in thousands of, I don't know if it's thousands, someone's going to correct me, friends on Facebook, tens of friends on Facebook that had any pro middle ground, let alone kind of, or centrist, let alone right wing political affiliation. And the easy thing would be to assume that social media and things like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, all these sorts of things, as a space for protest to mobilise. I mean, of course, to mobilise like-minded groups of people, but I don't think it's a space that's holistic enough or open enough to promote broad social change.
You can't be critical within that space, maybe.
Yes. I mean, it's precisely because those spaces are self-selected that they're easy to protest as such. But I think the interesting thing about Christchurch is we don't have like a civic space like these other movements have been in, because we just don't have the people going to do the red zone.
We did have the largest TPP protest and out of the country. Like, I think that was quite telling, that Christchurch, not Auckland, got on the streets. I mean, it was 3,000 people, so it's hardly giant, but at least it's something.
We were in the situation.
But let's think about the square, like, about civic space. Like, the square in Christchurch was pre-ruined. You know, I remember I moved to Christchurch when I was 11 or 12 or something, and that was right on the cusp of when things were changing. But I remember it being bustling with movie theatres around the edges, a centre for people to come in and congregate, culture, you know, in terms of movies, show, bands playing in the square regularly, markets, you know, buses coming and going, so it was a real hub for people to move through. And at some point in time, they paved it over with a slate or something that you could no longer...
Chinese marble, how
about that? Yeah, and which sunk literally into the sort of the sign of things to come. But like you can't even keep your eyes open because it's so glary, and you don't want to sit in there or stand in there, or there's no spaces really. I mean, it's a completely... it might as well be a Rickett and Moore car park with a, you know...
Well, you're not in a park.
Eh?
You're not in
the park. No, well, that's, maybe they should have put a car park in there. People might have come to town before the earthquake. So the idea now that the blueprint, I disagree completely with the principle of the blueprint for the central city, and I think it's a huge distraction to what actually is happening in broader Christchurch, particularly on the east side of Christchurch in areas like this. No one's talking about a large numbers of people who have lost kind of a collective identity.
and whose roads are not going to be fixed.
Yeah, yeah, and
you still can't get out.
There's a guy out in New Brighton who was a paraplegic, and he had no insurance because he couldn't afford it. And he's right by the river, and he can't move. You know, and they've told him, you know, we're not going to, if the power lines go down, we're not going to fix them. So you'll have to buy a generator. You know, if your sewage gets blocked, then we're not going to fix that because, you know, you had the opportunity to pay for insurance. And because you couldn't afford to pay for insurance, therefore it's your own fault that you're in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's bizarre stuff. I just think that the blueprint...
Being poor is a moral fault, so you deserve it right.
I've been reading this really interesting article by Boris Groys on art activism, and I think he... I put a little quote from it onto the Facebook page today, because I think he makes quite an interesting point. He talks a bit about the Russian avant-garde of the 1920s that is often seen as this real political moment when art seems to have some sense of agency. And then he talks a little about the 60s and 70s when it's kind of also a part of those civil rights movements, and even here up to the 80s, kind of where, you know, it was very much a part of general protest, was poster making and murals and all of that kind of stuff. But he says that today is different, and that what we have today is this moment where we already accept the failure of anything. So there's no, maybe it's better to quote him. The acceptance of one's own failure, understood as a premonition and prefiguration of the coming failure of the status quo in its totality. So he kind of suggests that artists don't feel like they need to respond with a blatant message of dissent, because actually the whole system needs to be overturned in some way, and that this post-revolutionary moment... there's also been a lot of talk around about accelerationism, you know, this idea that if we just keep it going but accelerate the capitalist machine, that it will somehow collapse. But do you see that as... is that why we have this sense of maybe it's seen as apathy, but it's actually this different approach? Does that resonate?
The way I see it is that we're actually, like, for instance, this purpose is this very, I feel like it's an awful situation.
And with the technology that we have today, which was, you know, like in the 18th century, you couldn't communicate to someone, even probably across the town, across the outside prostitutes, because there were no telephones or anything like that. So to process things, we had to do it in a different way.
But does it matter if you protest? Does it matter if we manage to get the whole of Christchurch on the street? Would that make any difference if nobody took a photograph? But I don't think it even matters if we did all protest. Like, I don't know if that makes a difference.
Would that perhaps why we don't do it?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder if there's, you know, the terrain has changed somewhat there, in the sense that if you go back historically, are people familiar with the Deleuze? There's a postscript on societies of control where he talks about Foucault's notion of disciplinary societies, which is more of the sort of societies that Foucault talks about, characterized by the school and the prison system and these things that use kind of discipline and constraint to regulate populations. Whereas Deleuze claims that later in capitalism we've moved more into control societies, which are more about open spaces and kind of overcoding and modulating subjects. I mean, I wonder if there's something there. I mean, and this also relates to things like the situation you're talking about in Hong Kong or Arab Spring and things as well. You could argue, say, those societies are still somewhat more disciplinary societies, where the society that we live under is more of a, you know, arguably a control society, which is more, you know, operates in a way where it's more permissive. So it's sort of almost in the sense, because power, for the most part, isn't so explicit. It isn't as...
we've internalised it.
Yeah, and it isn't as overt in its violence. But in a way, I mean, I think part of the other thing with that is that it almost says, express yourself, you know, live a wonderful life, do these things, and then it actually appropriates those values. So something like Facebook, something like that, is a kind of prime example in that sense, where it's, you know, this mode of communication, self-expression, all these things, but it's also a way in which, you know, Facebook accrues value and harvests a kind of a free form of flavor that's also used by the NSA, surveillance, all these things, right? So in a way, I mean, maybe it's like partially because power isn't as overt or explicit that it's almost harder to organize against.
And art plays a role within that production system as well anyway,
very
so
much.
There's no side of that.
It's just tied into those segments of exchange.
Yeah.
I think it takes a commitment to make something concrete and make a... Part of the problem, I suppose, is making something concrete and finding a meaningful mode of distribution. And, you know, for me, it's great to have images in a gallery space having a conversation with other really great work, you know, but I think it's still a really limited cocoon of a place to be, you know. And
it's four flights of stairs.
And it's great because there's a actual conversation happening with things out the window, and you can see Avonside and all those sorts of places where these things were taken. But, you know, the problem for me is, you know, it's outdoor exhibitions, public space exhibitions, you know, that were done in the past, large scale things where people walk past and they can read these details and photos or read details and text in an environment and reflect upon it right there on the spot, which is why this is good, you can see outside. But in terms of, you know, it takes a lot of, Chris is talking about kind of money and power structures and trying to exist outside that, but it takes a lot of monetary commitment to say publish a book which can be distributed, which people can hold and be tangible. And then, you know, I think, you know, in the past, you know, controversial content in China, places like that, you know, there've been secret big book burnings, which is a statement in itself. Things become notorious. I think at the moment now, like because of the economics of things, people distribute things digitally and it's fleeting and it doesn't have a life. It's so easy just to sort of sideswipe and go to the next page or something like that.
I think there's a positive value in adopting any medium that we're told is obsolete, personally. If they tell me it's obsolete, I'm going to use it. Because clearly they want to, you know, the way that capitalism is continually abolishing technologies and replacing them with new technologies so that we can buy something new. So don't use the new technologies, use the old ones. That's been a principle plank of mine. On my practice, and I think that, and I have a really highly developed position around that, which I won't bore you with, but I listening to this discussion just brings home to me, in a way, it's quite distressing, because it reminds me that actually I spend most of my time suppressing how angry I am about everything. You really, because you can't focus on being angry all the time, because it really fucks you up. But honestly, I am extremely angry, and all sorts of things really bring it out in me. You know, Facebook, for instance, really brings it out in me. And I mean, my ambition is to be the last person not on Facebook. I don't think I'm remotely going to manage it, which is great, because I don't want to get to a situation where I'm the only person in the world not on Facebook.
Oh,
can I be with you? Less things, and there you go. There's two. In any room, you're going to find at least two people who either can't or won't be on Facebook. But what you were saying earlier about the 18th century and means of communication, I think it's ironic that you know, someone like Osama bin Laden, I'm not terrible, awful man, I've got no sympathy for him or his ideals, but I thought it was interesting that that he found himself essentially forced into a situation where his only option for communication was to revert to precisely that 18th century level, send a messenger, write it on a piece of paper, give it to someone you trust, send it to another country where someone will read it, because nothing else is safe. Everything else is owned by, you know, by power, and so only by actually keeping away from all those beautiful means of self-expression that we've been lucky enough to be given, like social media, only by basically refusing them can we actually communicate in a way that isn't surveilled 24/7, 365 days of the year. And we might have been able to, those were paranoid ramblings, I think, up until when Edward Snowden basically got the world's biggest fucking whistle and blew the shit out of it. And so I'm very grateful to him for having done that, because basically there is no more paranoia. Anything you imagine as paranoid is undoubtedly true. And there's a great liberation in acknowledging I'm not paranoid. Because they're doing it.
Information's not power now, but holding your privacy and controlling your information is.
Yeah.
Did you have a question about Brett?
Yeah, I was kind of just picking up on what Tim was saying before, thinking about his thousands of friends on Facebook. But the idea that you're on that forum, you're kind of speaking to people that already share the same kind of viewpoints to you, largely. And relatively, we're kind of talking about audience, as though we know what that means. And I'm just kind of wondering what your thoughts are about who this audience is that these works are speaking to. And I guess, like, do you as artists and as curators, people that run these kind of spaces, have some sort of responsibility to try and engage new audiences if these works are about affecting the change? How do you do that?
Well, I guess for you, your ideal is on the street, right? Where it's in the public.
That's one way of doing it, like actually getting shows out in public spaces whereby people are forced to take notice. Well, you know, again, digital distribution and things online, on the web, you have to actually choose to enter an address in, or you have to choose to follow a link. And if you're not already invested in the subject or interested, you're not going to click on the link or type in the address. So exhibitions in public spaces are one way to do that. But I think, you know, books end up on strange people's bookshelves. They're in shops. People walk past them. They look at a pretty landscape or a not-so-pretty landscape, and it intrigues them, so they look at it. You know, you can inspire people to pick up and look and think in a whole lot of different kind of ways, you know. And I suppose, I mean, one comment I had on the opening night of this show was like, a woman came up to me and said, I really like your photographs, and I particularly like the first one down the end, and how much is it, and I'd like to buy it. And then she sort of had this statement following that, saying, I've got a friend in Wellington who studied art history, no offence, but she doesn't get it, she doesn't think it's good.
Right,
and I thought, well, I think it's interesting because, you know, if you're, I mean, in relating to your question, you know, like, I would just sort of, my responses to your question would be, well, it's up to me as an artist or someone who's invested in visual communication within any medium to kind of employ a language that is accessible enough to people without being too obvious, that people could enter into a space and reflect. I don't know.
I think one of the criticisms that's often levelled at art activism is that it aestheticises the problems or the politics, rather than bringing the politics to an aesthetic realm, kind of, or to an art gallery, say. But what I'm often disappointed at the lack of political work around. And so I see having this kind of show here is actually for an arts audience, is to say, actually, we need to stand up and make comment on things, and that this is a place for it, and so are other galleries, and so is, yeah.
I mean, one of the greatest, honestly, I don't know if there's anyone from the Christchurch Art Gallery here, there should be.
No.
I've been listening.
They did make the bulletin, actually.
One of my favourite pieces coming out of post-quake Christchurch was Rob Hood's installation at Jonathan Smart, with all the abandoned furniture and things, fans and things left behind in the gallery, which was used as the Sarah offices and things. And in my mind, they've been very supportive of me, so I'm not being too critical, but they should be buying that entire piece and putting it in the foyer for the opening day, so that everyone is confronted with it straight away. I don't care how much it costs.
Have you suggested it to them? It's a fantastic idea.
I have, on multiple occasions, and they can just...
I think that we're thinking.
But I don't know how far... There's a kind of an irony in that they would... I don't know if enough. They gave those things to Rolfe, and then he took them, put them together, and then they can buy them back.
Seems like a good system to me.
But, for me, I think it's, it takes the people in those positions of power, people buying artwork, if you think of the responsibility of the public collection and the kind of works that, what their mission is in terms of amassing a collection of work. There's obviously a large amount of artists in Christchurch and Canterbury now making work, very political work about the situation we've found ourselves in. And surely it should be up to them to sort of collect that work and keep record of it. I'm not sort of suggesting they should stop collecting the big paracophiles and things like that, because they're important in other ways too. But
did you have something to say, Richard?
Yeah, I was just wondering, do you guys think that there's some connection, if we're to talk about some sort of impoverishment of political art, do you think there's a connection to a broader impoverishment of politics? So if you go back with a lot of historically art that was political, a lot of that was quite tied in quite closely to the radical left politically, right? But before you guys were talking about this thing of almost like no one really believes anymore, and entered into the kind of postmodernism, the kind of equivalence of all narratives, and there's a sort of waiting for the world to end sort of in the dust of this planet, kind of Kanye West t-shirt, and the right-wing media puppet, all this stuff carrying on, right? But I mean, historically, until a certain point with the Soviet Union, a lot of artists and intellectuals in the West were heavily invested in a Marxist viewpoint, right? I mean, whether we're to talk about anything from like Dada and Surrealism, Situationism, all of these things, they were closely allied to a radical leftist position. And I think part of this, part of where that started to fall apart in Europe was around the late 60s, with the sort of so-called failure of like May 68 and things like that, right? In May 68, intellectuals, artists, students, allied with up to something like 7 million workers. 7 million workers were on a massive strike. The president fled the country. And then what? Then the government raised minimum wage and all the workers went back to work and the revolution ended. But I think there, it seems there's almost, going into the so-called end of history and the fall of the Soviet Union, all these things, there is this very much like an impoverishment of the left, more broadly, right? I mean, who really thinks that like Labour has a So I mean, but I wonder how much of this there's this problem here in terms of like who are we speaking to? Maybe historically, a lot of these artists who were radical leftists, they were concerned with, even if it seems naive, trying to create an art that speaks to the proletariat, right? That speaks to the people, that somehow represents their desires and stuff, and isn't bourgeois art, isn't a state art or whatever. I mean, maybe
Grace would say that those kind of early movements that really had that strong political edge to them had a natural political support from the actual politics, but that today is really different because you cannot be guaranteed that political support from anywhere, whether that is the Greens or a left or anything, that is actually, they're very separate now. And he sees that as a separation. And I sometimes look at artists' works, and a lot of artists go back into history and they find these perhaps esoteric or just kind of events or people or things, and they bring them into their work now and reuse them because of the political charge that exists with it. Say a feminist work from the 60s that they then reuse in their work today, because today trying to say you're a feminist becomes this really unwieldy, complicated thing. But if you just reference, say, something that, if you reference vagina scroll, then you somehow immediately have that charge that somehow... So I wonder if there is, as you say, this new political field that just makes it more complicated.
The terrain's changed, but even then, I mean, that bizarre thing with that is often those gestures that reach back historically, they seem so immediately nullified, because it's like then what was a radical gesture just becomes recycled as like an arbitrary, just another... It's just another meme or just another, floating in that, it's gone, and the terrain's changed. I mean, I wonder, there's that notion from Fridtjof Jameson that I think is quite interesting, and it's been deployed a bit in this discussions of like aesthetics on the left recently and accelerationism and all that kind of stuff is this notion of like cognitive mapping, which is this idea of like the problem of trying to actually represent the situation we're in, you know, trying to actually understand this global abstract situation to represent that in a way that can create other narratives that could go somewhere else. I mean, because that's the thing, I mean, who even is the left anymore? You know, like that's the whole thing with Labour that's kind of a joke, right? They're called Labour, you know?
Labour's changed, right? Labour's not what it used to be. We don't work in the same way. And
no, exactly, yeah.
You know, we now live in an information age. How does Labour rethink Labour, rethink itself when Labour is not industrial?
Yeah, when it's material.
Material, yeah. When it's data, how does that work? Mm. I've been reading, and I really like this guy, Biffo, who talks about an after the future, like we no longer have this optimism of a future ahead of us. We know that that doesn't work somehow. We already exist in this failure. And so what do you do after the future? What do you do once that's, you have to throw that away? You know, he doesn't have an answer. He just puts it out there. Yeah, it's the end. Does anyone else have any other thoughts or questions or comments? On this wide-ranging topic?
I'm going to say something. I don't have a problem when people regard what I do as elitist. Well, I do have a problem because I think that's fucking stupid, but and it really annoys me. But I look at it differently. Pierre Bourdieu has an interesting distinction in his analysis of cultural production, where you've got the field of general production, which is the mass market, and you've got the field of restricted production, which is producing for other producers. I'm unashamedly operating in the field of restricted production, where I know most of the people who are interested in what I'm doing. I'm working with most of the people who are interested in what I'm doing. And I don't see that as a weakness, I see that as a strength, because it's a group of people who share some presuppositions and who are, as I said earlier, collaborating gratuitously. And the what it is that we're collaborating on isn't really the point. The point is, how does that affect our consciousness? What's the change in thinking that comes from that? And I think an example of where that can be valuable, where that can become more general, is what happened after the earthquakes. There was that fantastic period after February 2011 when nobody went to work, nothing fucking worked at all. Yes, there was a lot of dreadful things going on, a lot of terrible things that happened, a lot of people were very unhappy, but it was permanent carnival. It was like, you could just, you know, barbecues, this is how I respond, barbecues, drinking, yeah, to dig a hole to go and shit in, but, you know, that was fun. I didn't mind doing that, you know, it just, because you knew you were alive, and I realised about a week into it that I had a sack of quicklime in my laundry, which had been bought for art purposes. But it was the best thing to throw into a long drop to kill the smell. So I went around the neighbourhood with a wheelbarrow full of quicklime and a bucket, distributing it to people. And, you know, I wrote a piece about this, which was called How I Became the Santa of the Long Drop Toilet. And I think that what was valuable about that was that people had suddenly the experience of their lives completely changed. The place was the same, everything was the same except worse, because the toilets didn't work and you know, there were, you know, people knew people who had been killed or injured and you know, not to denigrate all of that, but actually everybody was awake and alive and relating to one another in completely different ways, and that produced for a while a completely different state of consciousness. People thought differently, felt differently, and we're still seeing echoes of it in some of this kind of thing. I think, although we've all got disaster fatigue, I think that the level of cynicism in Christchurch society is very healthy, and you know, when you hear on the media people talk about the rebuild, I was going, shut up about what fucking rebuild? You know, what's happening out there isn't a rebuild, that's not rebuilding anything, that's somebody making a lot of money out of getting paid to pull down perfectly good buildings and build new ones. That's not a rebuild. That's cashing in. But what I think is important is that was that change in consciousness, that experience of living differently. It was the same thing during the 1981 tour, I can assure you. That was frightening and exhausting, but also immensely inspiring. And in fact, I think I've been running on that one ever since in terms of personal psychic charge. It informs a lot of what I do. And so to return to my original point about the art practice, the fact that it only affects a small number of people isn't important. What's important is that those people should be affected and can use that, if you like, psychic charge to accomplish other things, to make decisions differently, to think differently about everyday circumstances that they might find themselves in, to be more positive about their capability to actually have, agency, to have agency, you know, that whole thing, we have no agency, we are people to whom things happen, and the downside of what's happened with this, you know, the blueprint, is that that's fuckers doing stuff to us, and that's, I think, very negative, and it is a missed opportunity. The cynicism of that whole share idea, shit, you know, I'm willing to possibly think that somebody at the time thought that was really going to go somewhere, but actually I don't think anybody did. I think they had us pegged for fools from the get-go. And you know, in Littleton we had a before the whole share and idea shit happened, and I didn't go to the share and idea thing because I already had this experience in Littleton. We all got together for about an evening in a big tent. They put up a tent for us, and we got together in the tent, and everybody kind of threw ideas out, and it was really clear what the community wanted, and none of it has happened. Absolutely none of it. And that became apparent so quickly that I just thought, okay, I'm not being fooled by that again. I'm not going to play along. But unfortunately, I'm beginning to lose my track. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people have been fooled by it. And so to return to my original point, I think the value of a shared art experience is that it can produce a different way of thinking. And that, I think, in itself is important in a society that is where all information is controlled, where all our options are kind of locked down, where you can be, you know, either a barista or a share milker. And there's pretty much no other meaningful career path. So you might as well be an artist.
I guess what I'm second, like adding on to your thing, Barbara, about audiences, I feel disappointed that there's not a bigger audience or a better public discourse demanding this kind of work. Like, why do people out there not question things? Why do they just feel like, I don't know, that they don't have to be critical? I don't know them. I'm well next time.
But it is probably
I do think, you know, Bruce's cynicism. And I think that in many ways some sort of replaced naivety is quite useful in this environment, because in some ways people are, you know, what's left is right, really. There's no real political notion, but what there is, in a traditional sense, is not political. But what there is a desire, I think, for something political. There's a desire for something other that's increasingly becoming apparent, both in ways that are perhaps people seeing signs of what's coming in down the pipeline, and other people having influence upon them. And so in that context, the kind of apocalyptic that you talked about, in some ways I like the idea of apocalypse. Because, I mean, it's actually names behind the layer. So it's not necessarily beginning, it's not the end, it's actually a beginning with something else. So in some ways, there's these signs that you can see all around, and it's a matter of, I don't know what those are, I don't know what the answer is, that's the problem. often not political, but because if you get into an argument, people would say, well, you know, you can't
what's control. The alternative?
So, yeah. What are you going to do? You know, it's ridiculous. What's your alternative? You tell me. And I do actually think that communism is, in some ways, in the broader sense, going to happen because it's inevitable that the broader sense of the commons is unavoidable. You know, as resources decrease.
Communism or death?
Yeah. It's basically going to be forced upon people in what way that actually comes out.
Stalin would approve it.
But I do think in that context, I mean, art actually becomes, it is a constant search for something that is constantly asking who your audience is, where they are, how they move, how you can move them, how you can interrupt that process of thinking that is essentially tied into the very set ideas and a sense of hopelessness, the sense of cynicism that there's actually nothing left. So that's where I think the naivety and encouraging a sense of naivety, which I think Snowden actually illustrated beautifully. That was the perfect example of somebody who naively, not he knew what there was going to be consequences, he knew he was going into that situation, but he went into it in a way, whether you like him or you hate him, in a way that I think genuinely illustrated the naivety that politically is the perfect way forward. That's the only way forward, that's the only hope of escaping the cynicism of and crushing the cynicism where we've been overrun with experts who know everything. And everything and then fuck up everything. Whether it's the Fitzgerald Bridge or the whole fucking inner city. So yeah, it's in my place naivety, I think politically is essential. And that doesn't mean forgetting what's come from the heart from the past, actually means going back to the business. So when you mention data, surrealism, absolutely, but of course they're not going to be the same as they were in their original political social context, but in this context, they actually have some interesting ways of engaging with people, engaging with audiences that might provoke some different thinking, some different interactions, some more positivity.
Could I speak to you about your audience? I'm currently doing my research, my PhD on how people and things produce subjective well-being, followed a particular theory at institutional, communal, and personal levels. Needless to say, because of my theory, I'm absolutely inundated with information and kind of exhausted. But one of the things that I can generalize out of the information that I've gathered, your audience is traumatized. And interestingly, trauma has been for many years dealt with through cognitive therapy and medications. And recently, there's a really wonderful book out called The Body Keeps the Score. And it's by Bessel van der Kolk. And he was a very prominent psychiatrist who was one of the first people to use medication and things for people with PTSD. And he's come out and said, you know, we've done everything wrong. We have to change. And I know that I did everything wrong quite so trying to help my family. And just this week, my husband was standing in the dining room and a truck went by to, the wrong angle down the road, and he just went bashing, and I reached out and I grabbed him, and I said, it's okay. And the people I interview all discuss the quakes in their own way, and I've worked very, also with mental health professionals around town, and interestingly enough, they have this attitude of, well, it's been 5 years, just kind of get on with it, and it's only now that some of that is surfacing. That is the standard issue for trauma. And when you think about the levels of energy that we all went through, we have shaken baby syndrome. You know, we all experienced the type of energy that is unprecedented. So your audience here, I think, is traumatized in a large way. And one of the things, if you can conceptually bring movement back in with more of the art, that is, the mind-body connection is pivotal to bringing people out of this. And not enough people are addressing that. We've disappeared. No one's talking about our trauma. And the getting on with it and just it isn't going to work for traumatized people.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
So there's just something else to think about.
Just say that I'm a feminist. I think that feminist theory has moved on through different stages and has, you know, like I think it's quite it's changed since the 60s and 70s. And then I think, you know, after post-feminism and now feminism today, that has very different ways of thinking about women, about sexuality, all of that stuff. Like, I think there was a little period when people were nervous to say, you know, I'm a feminist or I'm making feminist art.
Well, they still are.
They still are, maybe, you know. But I feel like there's still issues that could be addressed there, and I still think it's something quite relevant to think about, work with. And now in our show we have a few projects that are talking about feminist history, and we're going to run a reading group, so come. It's going to be really good, but it has a lot of new theory around feminism. So, yeah.
Intersectionality and all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, just in your opinion, do you think that feminism is like something that's moving towards equality and looking at both genders being talked about unfairly, or do you think it should that it is specifically towards women's issues and how they are being treated unfairly, just women or
I think there's probably as many feminisms as there are women. Like, I think there's so many different approaches and different issues and things like that. I think that feminism itself, like, that's why I say it's a challenging term, because it's very broad
and it's a unified body.
And it's historically specific almost. Yeah, there's so much that's come out of that, and I think feminist theory underpins a lot of contemporary art and a lot of contemporary theory and practice in general that it's kind of disseminated now. So even artists who you would not normally consider feminist, I think, have been influenced by feminist theory. But of course, it is about equality, right? But
for everyone.
Yeah.
You might have in the early feminist theory was just like an opening up the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, maybe since we're straying a little from our topic, now is a good time to just say thanks everyone for coming along tonight. We had a talk earlier in the week about the transition recovery plan that I hope you all submitted on at 5 p.m. today. But it was really nice to bookend that with something that really focuses in on how art can relate to that political situation a little bit more. And I'd like to thank Bruce and Tim for both coming along and talking and sharing today as well. So thanks a lot.